Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking about some aspects of pharmacology, substance abuse. A lot of the active materials that we take as drugs sooner or later become non-useful. Substance abuse, that's a matter of definition on who you're talking to. And who's going to be the guest today is going to be Professor Charles France from the University of Texas Health Science Center in San Antonio. He's the endowed Baharesh Tiku Professor of Pharmacology at that institution. And so, Charles, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we get into the sort of interesting areas of what is pharmacology, what is substance abuse, who defines what's abusive and who doesn't, let's talk a little bit about yourself, Charles France. How did you become a scientist?
I stumbled into it, not unlike the way that many people make discoveries. I was a music major. I was a musician for my early life, a professional musician.
And, playing what sort of instrument?
My primary instrument was trumpet, but being a music major, I ended up playing a lot of everything. I came from a musical family. I traveled a lot as a kid playing music. And in my process of getting a music degree, took some science courses that really got my interest, and particularly how behavior could be controlled by things like drugs. And I foolishly applied to a number of graduate programs, thinking I wanted to go into that area. I was rejected by all of them, not to be dissuaded. I went to the University of Minnesota and took the appropriate coursework and eventually got into graduate school and began studying substance abuse. And I happened to be at the University of Minnesota when some really important discoveries were being made about the relationship between nutrition and drugs of abuse.
So that's an interesting – do you still play music?
I don't.
Do you not find that that's an abuse of your interest in music?
Well, not unlike people who have done things at a fairly high level. If you're not able to maintain it at that level, it's quite a disappointing thing.
Having right.
athletic friends who have played at a high level and sort of give up the sport if they can't keep it going. So, no, I'm not even tempted at weddings because I'm sure it would be an embarrassment.
All right. So anyway, pharmacology. You're a professor of pharmacology. What is pharmacology? We all think we know, but you're the expert. So just sort of outline the subject area.
The simple definition of pharmacology, it's the study of drugs on biological systems, and that is true at every level, whether it be the effects of drugs on cells or the effects of drugs on people. Not to be confused, as it is most commonly, with pharmacy. Pharmacy is often related to the dispensing of drugs and the medicinal use of drugs. People in pharmacology study drugs at many different levels, typically from a more basic science perspective, not necessarily related to medicinals per se. And it really covers the gamut of all drugs and all biological systems. It's a very integrative science. It includes biochemistry, it includes molecular biology, all of the basic units of science. But it's integrated because it addresses specifically how drugs impact biological systems, and in my case, how drugs of abuse impact the behavior of individuals.
And by individuals, that not just humans, but of course a lot of the work that people in pharmacology do is with animal studies.
Absolutely. My lab is predominantly doing animal studies. Obviously, for reasons of ethics and safety, we can't test all the hypotheses we would like to test in humans. And drugs have to be evaluated. Part of the work that people like myself do is to evaluate potential new pharmaceuticals, both for the pharmaceutical industry and for regulatory agencies. There are studies in animals that remain the gold standard for agencies like the Food and Drug Administration to determine whether drugs are likely to be abused if put on the market and therefore whether they need to be restricted in some fashion, that is to have prescriptions written for them rather than just putting them on the shelf.
A lot of people get confused when they see this sort of strong interaction between the drug manufacturers, the quote unquote the big pharmas, and different universities and the interaction with the FDA, for example, because they need expert panels, and you can't sort of devise techniques to sort of separate those three because you've got to work together. I mean, how much money, for example, does a place like the University of Texas Health Science Center, Department of Pharmacology, get from industrial pharmaceutical companies?
That's a question I can't answer in terms of what the department gets. I can speak to my own experiences of having done this for some 20 years that my laboratory has had as much as 5 or 10% of its annual budget be supported by either the pharmaceutical companies or by the regulatory agencies. Who need those data because laboratories like mine have fairly unique skills that can evaluate drugs in ways that the pharmaceutical industry can't. It would be forbiddingly expensive, for example, to a pharmaceutical industry to have in place all of the procedures that we have to ask basic science questions in order to evaluate their drugs. So instead they come to us on an as-needed basis to look at these compounds.
We'll come on to the sort of specific unique skills in a minute, but presumably then all those sorts of interactions have a sort of an external ombudsman to make sure that your credibility is maintained, and yet at the same time a certain proprietary information from the drug industry is also maintained.
Absolutely. It's a fine line, but we have individuals at the university who make it their living to make sure that both sides of that equation are balanced quite nicely. There are conflict of interest agreements put in place. Everything is transparent from the university's point of view. The data in terms of drug evaluations of these sort that are typically done on a contractual basis are purely proprietary for the company, and oftentimes, essentially all of the time, the drugs are evaluated in a perfectly blinded fashion. That is to say, the compound is provided as a white powder with a number, and it's evaluated in a standard assay, and the data are returned, and that's the end of the relationship.
So you won't know yourselves what is the blind sample and what is the ingredient that they expect to be active.
Precisely right. That makes for better science, and it makes for a better relationship with the pharmaceutical industry.
And how at the end do you know that the result that gets sort of broadcast is the right result?
You don't. Really, the honor is on the company's behalf because they have contracted you to generate those data, and the data go back to them and they handle them as they will, and we certainly have to trust that they take the appropriate information to the regulatory agencies, and oftentimes we don't know whatever happens to those data. They could be drugs that we're taking today. They could be drugs that were eliminated from the pipeline because of the data that we provided. We simply don't know.
So there's a transparency, and yet there's an opaqueness between the result that you provide and the end user of that data, which is it's interesting by itself. That's the way that that particular type of science works.
It is the way the science works, though I suspect that there are plenty of checks and balances in the system. I'm not within the pharmaceutical industry, but in this type of work, professors like me oftentimes provide a formal report that's given to the pharmaceutical industry, and those reports oftentimes are given verbatim to regulatory agencies in addition to other information in the dossier. So they know in this case, for example, that Charles France has in fact generated these data and attests to the fact that they were generated in the fashion that he says they were.
And in fact, then, that would be part of the record that goes, for example, to the FDA or somewhere else, that these examinations, these tests were conducted in the France laboratory.
Precisely.
It's interesting. So you have a responsibility, which is rather great, but you also don't know the end product sometimes, and I find that really interesting.
It's an important public health issue to evaluate these compounds to see whether they do have abuse potential.
Tell us a little bit. You say you've got unique skills, unique equipment, unique procedures. What are these unique aspects of your research group?
Much information is learned about drugs acting on biological systems at other levels of analysis in terms of drugs acting on cells, drugs acting on tissues. But ultimately, with regard to things like substance abuse, things like other psychiatric disorders, whether they be anxiety or depression, the ultimate pathology is a behavioral disorder. So you have to study behavior, and that requires intact organisms that are performing some task that can be quantified in a reasonable kind of way. For substance abuse, we have had for many years an assay that has a great predictive validity. That is to say, what the animals provide us in terms of data gives us a very indication of what's going to happen in people. Turns out for substance abuse, it also has something called face validity. It looks in animals the way it looks in humans. And in this case, it's that animals are quite willing to take drugs, to self-administer drugs in ways not unlike humans. So animals can be trained to ingest drugs orally, to smoke marijuana, to take intravenous infusions of drugs. This is a seminal area of research that developed over the last 50 or 60 years and has provided a very rich empirical basis from which to evaluate the effects of drugs as related to their abuse liability in people. That's a lot of words to say that animals take drugs and people take drugs. And many of the same factors that control drug taking in humans control it in animals. Now, we don't presume that animals are drug addicts. There are certainly many factors that occur with humans in terms of peer pressure, access to drugs, social pressure, and the like that we don't introduce in the laboratory. But we can isolate the actual features of drug taking in animals in a way that's very predictive of what goes on in humans. So what does that mean? It means that drugs that people take, animals are quite avidly willing to take, with a few exceptions, and drugs that animals take, people are willing to take. So if we have a new pharmaceutical agent that we want to put on the market for whatever indication, if we think it's going to act in the brain, could be an antidepressant drug, it could be a pain reliever, it's of relevance to know whether the monkeys are willing to take it, because if they're willing to take it, there's a very good probability that humans are going to take it. Now, that piece of data is not used in isolation. It's used in combination with lots and lots of data from a cellular, biochemical, and other level. But if, in the end, animals will take these drugs and take them avidly, we have reason to be concerned about the availability of those drugs to humans. None of these decisions about regulatory issues of drugs get made in isolation, and they certainly don't get made based upon data obtained purely from animals. But when one gets that sort of positive signal from an animal, you certainly are compelled to then take that compound to the next level, which would be to give it to humans, to see whether they too show behavioral effects which would be indicative of substance abuse. So your answer was, what are the unique skills? The unique skills are not unique to my laboratory, but they're unique to a shrinking number of laboratories in terms of being able to evaluate what we would consider to be the abuse liability of drugs in non-human species, that is, do the animals avidly take the compound, so as to be able to make some reasonable guesstimate as to whether the drug is likely to be abused if made available to people.
So now we go animals and then we go people. Where do we start on the animal kingdom? Do we start with rats, mice, or is there even... And then we move up, I think you mentioned monkeys. What's the scale of order? Or is it not necessarily always the same?
It's not necessarily always the same, although the same general effects are obtained across species, and that's one value of this sort of approach. It has great generality across species. For practical reasons, we often use one species over another. Much of the work that's done in the pharmaceutical industry is done in rats. That's just been historically true. Many biochemical studies, molecular biology studies are done in rats. So oftentimes we'll use rats to evaluate these procedures or evaluate the compounds. For practical purposes, non-human primates, that is monkeys, are oftentimes used for these studies.
But do you always go from rats to – I mean, if you find something in a rat, you know, the avidity, as you put it, for substance abuse and enjoying it and having certain mental aberrational behaviors, well, you find that in a rat, you then automatically move on to a monkey model?
Not automatically. As I indicated, the concordance among species is quite strong so that one would not necessarily be compelled to look at another species for the same effect. If a strong positive signal comes up in one species, the immediate response, oftentimes from a pharmaceutical industry perspective, will be to immediately take a look in humans, though occasionally we look in a second species to provide a confirmation.
Okay, hang on. So the rat is a perfectly respectable model for human behavior in this one area of substance abuse as a generality.
It can be.
So now then you say, okay, then we've got to go to the next stage, or the pharmaceutical industry does, or someone has to, testing them on humans. And now this is where it gets sort of to be interesting. So people have to volunteer for this.
Or they get paid.
Yes. Is there a particular modus operandi which is generally accepted as appropriate, or do sometimes you go to groups of people who are sort of entrapped, prisoners, for example, or is this permitted? What are the guidelines to who you can use in your people study, human studies?
I don't do human studies.
No,
I know a little bit about it. Certainly, historically, there was a population of prisoners in Kentucky who were used to evaluate many, many substances by the U.S. Public Health Service. It was a very long...
In the same group had a whole different range of opportunities?
Yes, absolutely. And they received many drugs over a long period of time. That's no longer the case. Now it's people who are not incarcerated, people who are paid, and this kind of work is done oftentimes at medical centers with people who may have some substance abuse history. Oftentimes the kinds of questions that are asked to humans are whether drugs can be recognized as being like or unlike reference compounds. So for people, for example, who are abusers of sedative hypnotic drugs, benzodiazepines, you can test your compound and ask them, based upon standardized rating scales, whether this makes you feel like a drug that you have familiarity with. You can also ask people whether they feel good when they take the drug, or whether they feel bad, or whether they feel drowsy, whether they feel stimulated, whether they feel angry. And given this composite of effects and known effects for reference compounds, you can make reasonable suppositions about whether the drug is likely to have an abuse liability like reference compounds.
Interesting, interesting, interesting. We've got to take a break. This is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Charles Franz, who's a professor of pharmacology at the University of Texas Health Science Center in San Antonio. We shall be back.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. Mothers who breastfeed often joke and coin their milk liquid gold. Well, it may not be gold, but it is just as valuable to a baby's health.
Not only are breastfed babies more resistant to disease and infections, they face lower rates of juvenile diabetes and cancer. Now we're learning breast milk contains stem cells that become parts of a baby's various organs.
We learned nearly a decade ago about stem cells in breast milk. They have a molecule on their surface called nestin, which is indicative of adult multipotent stem cells. Multipotent are not totipotent, which can become any cell type.
However, these nestin-positive multipotent stem cells do become liver and pancreatic cells, as well as other tissues. Even more surprising is the latest discovery.
They found that the breast stem cells in a mouse pup left its stomach, traveled into the blood, and became a functional part of the pup's various organs.
Scientists tracked the stem cells by creating lactating mice that produce a protein to make their cells glow red. These mice were given pups to nurse. When the pups became adults, researchers found red glowing cells in the blood and in tissues such as the brain, thymus, pancreas, spleen, and kidneys.
And these were functioning cells. The ones in the brain looked like neurons, and the ones in the liver made albumin. Scientists now wonder if the stem cells are there to create a tolerance for the mother's milk, or do they play a role in normal growth?
What this discovery does present is an ethical source of multipotent stem cells, non-invasively and sustainably. This removes significant hurdles for certain researchers. Talk about owing our moms. This would be a biggie.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Charles France, Professor of Pharmacology at the University of Texas Health Science Center in San Antonio. And we're talking about substance abuse and how you can, in fact, test new substances that are potentially coming on the market to have the capacity to be abused. And we got to the point where you will, in fact, now have human volunteers, not you yourself, I understand, but the industry, the way they do it. And so, in fact, here's a career for people who, in fact, used to be substance abusers. I mean, they can come in there and volunteer and be sort of guinea pigs for new potential substances of choice for abuse. It's an interesting idea.
Well, it certainly is an ongoing industry before the drugs are regulatory issues are decided upon by the FDA is to have humans sample these drugs.
I mean, does it not have some danger to it in the sense that, you know, some people who are in fact in previous sort of life, if you like, or currently are substance abusers to suddenly get overreacted to the materials? How are the experiments done? Well, first of all, how are the experiments done with the animals? Right, and what happens to the animal after an experiment, and then what happens when it goes to the humans and the concept of multiple opportunities for different drugs being tested on one human person?
Okay, I can't speak with great expertise about the human situation because that's not work that I do, but I can speak about the animal research, which is research that asks animals whether they are willing to make a response to take a drug and to compare that response to what they might do for a reference compound. So we have well-known drugs of abuse, drugs like cocaine and drugs like heroin, which, as I indicated earlier, animals are readily able to take. So an animal might be equipped with an intravenous catheter where they could get an infusion of drug. They might be trained to put their lips on a spout where they could get a drink of drug. In fact, people train animals to put their mouths on a device where they get an inhalation of something like marijuana or tobacco. In any of those cases, the response is for the animal to do something in order to get the psychoactive substance, and you can train them to do that. And if you then substitute the new compound that you're interested in studying, you can see whether the animal's behavior persists or dissipates. And with appropriate kinds of control experiments, you can say with some surety over some range of doses and conditions that this drug is or is not maintaining the behavior, and it is or is not like a reference substance.
Clearly, I want to make the audience well aware that we're not your research isn't to discover new, delightful, recreational drugs. It's simply to take materials that have got some therapeutic utility and find out the ability of those to induce some form of abuse. So painkillers, for example, I mean, it's not even a question that if you suffer from minor pain and you take a pill for some description and it gets rid of the pain, you're going to be addicted to those in the end because even at the onset of pain, you're going to take it. I mean, is it not automatic that painkillers will be abused in some sense in our society?
I don't think so. I'm not a pain expert, though I know a fair amount about drugs that are used to treat pain. And I think given the number of people who take drugs for pain and the number of individuals who actually become physically dependent on or addicted to those drugs after their pain experience would say that no, pain is actually a good preventative for the development of addiction. I have taken them myself, and many people have taken opioids for lots of different things, whether it's been minor surgery or having your wisdom teeth extracted. And more commonly, people take these drugs for the relief of pain, and when the pain is gone, they stop taking the drugs. That's not true for everybody, but it's true for some. But now we have a problem in this country with so-called pain relievers like Oxycontin, these very long-acting drugs. They're essentially the same as morphine. They're marketed slightly differently. The drugs are not used by young people because they're suffering from pain. You know, 10 to 14% of high school kids have sampled these drugs. They take them because they feel different. They feel good. They get a high. It really doesn't have anything to do with the relief of pain. So depending upon who you talk to in the medical community, some would actually say that individuals are undertreated for pain because of the concern about the development of addiction, when in fact the data do not support the view that treating pain causes addiction.
Let's go back then to your animals. Once you've done a study on an animal, what happens to the animal? You then put them on a natural, normal diet for a month, a week, or and then start up with a second experiment? I mean, how long is the lifetime of the experimental rat in this business of taking different substances to see how it likes them?
It depends upon the experiment. Oftentimes with rats, we are interested in studying other consequences of the drug. So we might be interested, for example, in looking at the brain neurochemistry to see if things in the brain have changed as a consequence of the drug experience. The industry might be interested in looking at other tissue organs to see whether things have been changed, the cardiovascular system or the liver. And of course, rats have a relatively short lifespan, so their duration in these sorts of experiments is limited sometimes by the mechanisms by which we deliver the drugs. For example, intravenous catheters have a limited life under these sorts of biological conditions, or because the need to perhaps sacrifice the animals to ask other questions about the biochemistry of the pharmacological intervention. That's not true for non-human primates. Non-human primates are used for their natural life in many laboratories, including my own. And in fact, I think one could argue that this may be a particularly good model for looking at substance abuse, because many humans who sample new pharmaceuticals are themselves quite experienced with other drugs. Seldom is it the case that they're a totally naive individual. So that biological background of a monkey who perhaps has had multiple drug exposures may provide a better assessment of what goes on in humans.
What's the time span in between one set of investigations and another, say for a primate?
Well, that will depend on a lot of things. Sometimes we study drugs that have long actions, and we therefore need to let the animal eliminate all of that compound. But typically, several months will intervene between successive tests. And I should say earlier, we talked about rats and we talked about monkeys and the use of species. And of course, this is a very important topic in today's society in terms of concerns about the use of animals in biomedical research. Animals are not interchangeable. I mean, we really use a particular animal because it is the best thing for the experiment we're doing. Based upon your comments earlier, we might suppose that a non-human primate and a rat would be interchangeable. That's true for some experiments. It's not true for other experiments. There are some very clear examples where the metabolic byproducts of drugs are entirely different in a rat and in a monkey. And of course, it's not just the molecule you give. It's the molecule that ends up acting in the brain, which oftentimes is a byproduct of what you've given. And there are some profound examples of where we completely miss the boat in a rat because the rat wasn't making the metabolites that, in fact, monkeys and humans do make. So oftentimes there will be a pharmacokinetic, that is to say, a metabolic profile of a drug that we'll know before we actually go into these behavioral studies. And that will determine the kind of animal we go in, because we'll want to model the metabolic profile of humans as best we can in asking the animal that question.
Is there a clear difference in the metabolic pathways for primates and humans? Can you think of a particular example, like the one you just thought about for the rat? Are there very glaring examples where the experiment with the primate was totally missed, or we missed what was going to happen with humans because of different metabolic pathways?
Not in my experience, no.
Okay, so I mean, we are, so the monkey and the primates are by far the best predictors of human behavior in that sense.
If you had to select one, I would say yes.
Right. Now tell me, I mean, you alluded to the point, and I wasn't really going to go there because it's not something I have a great deal of knowledge at, but I mean, I suppose the audience would be interested. Do you get much in the way of, I don't want to call it hate mail, but do you and your group, because of what you do and it's high profile, do you get much negative impact from random parts of society? Does that make your job rather difficult?
No, because I think those of us who are in this field believe in what we're doing, and we know that without the use of animals in research, we would be in a very sorry state, not only from the development of pharmaceuticals, but from the development of all medicines.
I agree. I mean, doesn't stop you being subjected to some inappropriate and rather nasty behavior.
Certainly that has happened in my career, and certain, my colleagues from around the country have suffered some really unfortunate situations. We have been left relatively alone in San Antonio, but there are also incidents that have involved people who object to what we do.
And presumably over the years, you've seen a big improvement over the way that the animals themselves have been housed and maintained. I mean, I think, you know, some of the very earliest examples of how research labs would, I'll say, treat their animals when they was not very appropriate. But nowadays, I've been in research laboratories, and people bend over backwards to make sure that every aspect of that animal's behavior or life, should I say, is beyond criticism.
It's an exceptionally highly regulated industry. The animals are supervised on a daily basis from specialized veterinarians and laboratory technicians. We're inspected on a very regular basis. We have to meet regulatory agency standards. The animals are treated exceptionally well. The lifespan of non-human primates in laboratories is 3 or 4 times longer than it is in the wild.
They used to say the same thing about bullfights, of course, right? The average bull in a bull arena is, you know, already had 2 years more than the average other bull.
The animals are very well cared for.
Right.
Very well cared for.
Tell us what you're particularly into right this minute. What is the key area that today you get up in the morning and say, my God, it's another day in the lab. Let's go.
There are so many things. I have a fantastic job. I'm developing a collaboration with people from El Paso on a topic that's near and dear to my heart and one that's quite exciting. I think it has to do with the relationship between what we put in our mouths and how we respond to drugs. So how nutrition and physiological status impact the effects of drugs of abuse. We know that there are lots of interesting relationships between eating disorders and substance abuse, and what our work is finding out is that relatively modest changes in dietary habits can have rather profound effects on brain neurochemistry and drug responses. So let me give you a couple of examples. One is if you simply restrict the amount of food that a rat can eat. If you normally feed a rat 20 or 25 grams of food a day, just cut that down by 30 or 40% for a couple of weeks. And what we find is that the way that certain chemicals are acting in the brain, most prominently dopamine, which is a very important drug in the chemical with regard to making us feel good about things, the way that the brain handles dopamine is markedly changed just by that small manipulation in diet, by slight food restriction. And it's not just a biochemical anomaly. The animal shows a markedly different response to drugs that act on dopamine systems. There's lots of drugs that act on dopamine systems that are important to all of us. From my perspective, drugs like cocaine, drugs like amphetamine, that are both abused but are also used medicinally. Drugs like amphetamine, of course, being used for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. There are other drugs that act on dopamine systems, antipsychotic drugs, drugs used in movement disorders. So to the extent that small decreases in food intake change dopamine systems, that could be important not only for abuse but for medicinals.
Well, I mean, enlarge upon that. In what way does that reduction in the dietary intake, is it an impact that says that now the cocaine or whatever you're using is more effective, less effective?
It's a more complicated story than that. We're at the early stages of, but we know that the primary site of cocaine in the brain, which is something called the dopamine transporter, is changed very dramatically by modest food restriction in animals. And we know that that occurs much more in an adolescent animal than in an adult animal. So this may have implications for vulnerability to substance abuse, for example, in young people.
Charles France, thank you for being here. You're the Maharesh Tiku Professor of Pharmacology at the University of Texas Health Science Center in San Antonio. I'd like to thank Norma Martinez for the big smile, and I'd like to thank you out there for listening, and we'll be back next week with another Science Studio. Bye-bye.